Reinhold Messner is probably the world's greatest living mountain climber. He's scaled all 14 of the world's tallest peaks, and he was the first to climb Mount Everest alone without oxygen. He's one of those guys who seems to feel most alive when he's facing death. And now he's written a memoir, which reads like a novel. It's called Reinhold Messner, My Life at the Limit. Steve Paulson caught up with him and asked how he got hooked on climbing.
I started climbing as a small boy. My father brought me on a 9,000 feet peak, 10,000 feet probably, in the Dolomites. And I had only 5 years before I
went
to school.
You were 5 years old and you climbed a 10,000 foot peak?
Yes, it is not a difficult climb, but it's a small rock climb, but it's very long. So I suffered under the fatigue because it was not easy. I remember very well reaching the summit, and I was not so impressed by the summit. I was very impressed by the huge world around me because I was living before in a very narrow, small valley. This was my home place. And I could not see more than maybe 10 square kilometers.
Now, you said that your father was the one who took you up on that mountain when you were 5 years old. And he was really the one who taught you to climb, right? But it sounds like you had a really difficult relationship with him. I mean, not just you, but all of your siblings as well. I mean, to the point where he would beat you and your other brothers
Yes, this was normal in this period after the Second World War. And the father was a climber in the 30s before he went to the war. My father helped me to become a very good rock climber up to the 16 years, I would say. He never stopped us. I was not only the only one in the family. We all went to rock climb. And especially my younger brother, Günther, and myself, we became really extreme rock climbers.
Yeah. A bit later, when you were in your early 20s, you got into high-altitude mountaineering, first to the Andes, then to the Himalayas. And clearly, one of the pivotal experiences of your life was climbing Nanga Parbat, which you describe as the watershed, a demarcation line between your youthful exploits as idealistic, obsessive rock climbers and high-altitude Himalayan mountaineering. What happened on that first trip?
On Nanga Parbat, we pushed it to the limits, the Nanga Parbat Rupal Face. The Rupal Face is the highest wall of the world. It's more or less five, six times the wall of El Capitan. Very high altitude, 8,125 meters. And we were fascinated by this wall. We didn't go to climb Nanga Parbat. We went to do the wall, the difficult climb.
Yeah, and you went with your brother, Günther.
Yes. We stayed in the wall for 40 days preparing fixed ropes and preparing camps. And on the end, we were in a very tiny situation because we got information from the base camp, the weather will change. We were in the last bivouac. It was not either anymore a camp, it was a bivouac. And in this situation, I decided by myself, I would like to try a solo ascent without rope, without nothing. So I'm very quick and I will go up, if possible, to the summit and back. And the others in the last camp, my brother and a German filmmaker, they should, in the meanwhile, follow me a little bit and leave some ropes. And afterwards, we would immediately go down to the base camp for not being trapped by the bad weather. So I started at 3 o'clock in the morning, maybe 35 below zero, without anything, with gloves naturally and clothes, but no rucksack, no pitons, no rope, nothing. And I could climb quite well. It was possible to do. Nobody touched this part of the wall before. When I reached 7,950 meters, 150 meters below the summit, I could see that my brother was following me.
Günther, he was not supposed to be coming up after you, was he?
Not supposed. He decided by himself. He was free to decide like this, but he did not tell me that he will follow me, but he did it. So we were in a very precarious situation near the summit. The high difficulties were below us. We had a quite easy ground in front of us, and we did the mistake to go further. But we were interested to reach the summit because the wall was climbed only if we would have gone to the summit. So we went both together, the last piece to the summit. It went easier and easier up to the summit. We reached the summit. My brother became slower. And when we left the summit for going down, it was quite late. It was too late in reality. So on the way down from the summit, I understood that my brother was not anymore perfectly handling the climbing. And he was beginning to be high altitude sick. And it was not possible, not thinkable, to go down with a high altitude sick person. And now we were totally trapped and we had to go down somewhere. We were not willing to sit down at 8,000 meters and wait for death.
Well, and you had not brought any equipment, any sleeping gear to be able to be overnight on the mountain at that altitude.
We had no bivisack, no sleeping bag, no tent, no cooker, no food, nothing. And we went down a little bit on the other side of the mountain where it's not so steep. But we did not know if we would have a chance to go down to the base of the mountain because we could not see from up. It was only abyss on all sides. So we took a place and we stayed for a whole night. It's a miracle that we both survived. And we tried to go down on the other side. And we went down. I went ahead looking for a route. My brother was following. If I give him a sign, come over.
Because you said that Gunther didn't have the energy to go down and then to come back up if the route wasn't the right
one. He was too sick. So in this system, we were able to go down, and we did a second bivouac in the middle of the wall. It was not so dangerous anymore and not so cold, but anyway, in the meanwhile, we were very, very tired. And on the third day, always without water and without food, we reached the base of the wall, the Diamir wall, exactly the opposite side of the mountain. And there was a big problem to reach the green areas, the green meadows. We could see the green meadows below us, but between us and the green meadows, there was a broken glacier with hundreds of crevasses. We understood we have to look to find a way going around these crevasse areas. And again, I said to my brother, wait, maybe half an hour. I will see if I can surround these crevasses. And during my searching to find a way out of this dangerous situation, he was cut by an avalanche. And I went back after a while searching for him, but I could not take away the ice blocks.
And had you known that he had been caught in an avalanche?
I could see it when I came back, because on the place where he had to be, it was all new snow and all new ice blocks. And in this moment, I was very schizophrenic. I had on one side always the feeling my brother is somewhere. I also had the feeling he's yelling somewhere. The whole night I was looking and hoping and sleeping because I was so tired, and waking up again and having the feeling my brother is somewhere, and afterwards knowing that my brother is under the avalanche. I became totally crazy.
And by that point, you probably figured that your brother was dead.
No, I knew it. But between the knowledge and the feeling was a difference.
Do you feel any responsibility for your brother's death?
I feel the whole responsibility. All the responsibility is mine, because he's not anymore alive.
There's something that you say when you have talked about this tragedy. You've written, it is through resisting death that we humans experience what it is to be human. It sounds like you're saying if we don't risk death, we're not fully experiencing what it means to be human.
If somebody is not knowing that we are dying, and with our birth we are dying human. And only if we know that we are limited in our life, we are strong in living. I'm sure about this. And I have to say, the most dramatic situations of my life I had on Nanga Parbat, the story I told you now in a few words. It was the hardest thing I had to support and to go through, but it was the most important moment of my life, because really I was dying. The death was the simplest thing. I had the feeling now it's over, and I forgot about myself, and I became unconscious, and I woke up again because I had this last part of energy, and I went further. But I had the experience to quite die. But death is the key of life after birth. With 25, I knew that life is limited, and I was trying to fill it up day by day, second by second, year by year.
Did that experience on Nanga Parbat, losing your brother, nearly dying yourself, did that change you in some way? Were you a different person after that?
My first life was over, and I begin a few months later, a second life. You have to understand that my brothers and my parents, they tried to stop me finally and said, finish your studies and forget about mountaineering. And after a few months, I understood that if I would quit with mountaineering and I would do something else, I would become an unhappy person, because there were many visions and dreams in my brothers and my mind before having this tragedy. And I could cope better with my brother if I would go further. And from this moment on, I became a high-altitude climber.
You clearly are a very driven man. I mean, obsessed, some people would
obsessed.
Say.
You can say obsessed. I don't think that I'm driven.
Of course you're driven. Everything that you've said, you're remarkably driven.
I have strong ideas.
But, I mean, you're also pretty upfront about how there were trade-offs in what you did. I mean, your first marriage fell apart because you were gone so much. There were long stretches when you didn't see your children.
Yes.
Do you have any regrets about those choices you made?
No. Not for this, no.
I have to ask then, you have several kids. I mean, have you taught them to climb?
Yes.
Have they taken on these kinds of risks that you did when you were younger?
My son is a very good rock climber now. He's going also on ice. It's very difficult for me to see it, but I accept it. I have to accept it. And for a while, I was very, I know what he's doing, and I know what can happen, but I cannot stop him. I will not stop him. He's studying, but he's doing risky things. I understand perfectly that he loves to do it, and he's doing it. And if I say, you know, this is dangerous, be careful there. Normally, he's also saying to me, Papa, don't speak this bullshit. You know exactly what you did, and I do what I have to do.
Reinhold Messner is one of the world's greatest living mountaineers. He was talking with Steve Paulson about his new book, Reinhold Messner, My Life at the Limit. There's another great story he tells about taking a 28,000-kilometer walk across Antarctica. We didn't have time for that in this show, but we'll post it on our website at ttbook.org.